How are you?
I'm doing good.
Been busy, been doing fun stuff, working on the AC biz. Never-ending amount of projects, especially with heat right around the corner, as they say.
How do you feel about... I have a question. So your whole family history has been BMW, it feels like. Like, I had you on for the episode back when we were talking shit about 911s. Like, we were like, what would you rather have instead of a 911? How many E28 M5s could you have? And we went through this whole thing about how the E28 M5 was better. It's better, it's better, it's better. And lo and behold, now you have a 911, which you seem absolutely obsessed with. You seem to love it. You seem to be buying into the how it how does it feel to be a 911 owner instead of a M5 owner? Like, well, in addition to M5 owner.
Yeah, I think in addition to does not help the ego, but I do understand the 911 pretentiousness. One, people at Cars Coffee are 10 times more annoying now than they were before. But two, I kind of get it. It's a great looking car and it's really fun to drive. I don't know. It's just so different than everything else. And everybody's happy about it.
Who? What do you mean? What do you mean everybody's happy about it?
Like, okay, so like you drive around like a Ferrari, right? Or you drive around like some like Lamborghini, Huracan, whatever.
I don't know what that is like.
I don't know what that is. Do you? Who is this hypothetical person? Is it you?
Okay. No. I don't have any of these things. But hypothetically, right? Someone drives this around, categorized wholesomely as a douchebag. Most people do not like this person.
Can you define wholesome douchebag?
Yeah,
if we define those two things separately, wholesome means somebody that's kind of down to earth. Maybe they bake pie. Maybe they love turkey dinner. They love Thanksgiving better than Christmas.
Grandma is wholesome.
Grandma's wholesome. Yes. She loves Easter. Douchebag is the uncle opposite. That doesn't show up not to correct. Easter. It doesn't show up, but then expects to come the next day and still have the leftovers. Okay, so that's the douchebag. So, wholesome douchebag is a grandma that doesn't show up until the day afterward.
I think it's a hybrid, right? This person is actually a good person, but most people think they're a douchebag, which makes them kind of like a good guy, right? Yeah. But either way, you go to a gas station, 98% people, they're not going to like the guy with the purple Huracan. But oddly, because time always heals everything that's poor, red 911 that's old, people think like, oh, cool old car. Like, it's a very approachable thing. And everybody seems to have a story about it. Everybody seems to have like a, oh, I saw this in a rap video, or I saw this on TikTok, or my dad had one in high school, or I grew up with one of these in the 70s or something like that. So it's like a much more approachable car.
Is it the brand or is it the attention. Like, if you showed up with a Countach, do you think you'd be having the same conversations in a red Countach?
I mean, I don't know. I've never driven one of those. But I think the difference is the shape of the 911 has been unchanged for so long that 98% of people might think it's the same car, but then realize like, oh, I saw one last week and it's actually from like 68 instead of 89. But they have no idea what the difference is. Therefore, that shape has been burned in everyone's head as like, oh, this is an old Porsche.
Yeah, I think, well, we have to work on the Porsche, iconic. Porsche, Porsche thing. We got now that you're a Porsche
syllable
owner,
word.
Two-syllable word, two Porsche. Syllable word. You know, we can...
I don't think I care that much, to be honest.
as well, you shouldn't. And I sound like a wholesome douchebag telling you it's two syllables instead of one.
Yeah, what can I say?
Yeah, I think the 911 is like different taste too, especially an old 911. If you look at like a brand new GT3 RS and a brand new Aventador or something like that, I don't think the owner's that different. Like, well, I think that they're kind of the same guy.
It's literally the scene from Gone in 60 Seconds with Nicolas Cage, where he's like, but if I owned a 1964 California blah, 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 I would be.
You would be a connoisseur.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. 100%.
That's exactly it. That's a good call, Jake.
I think it bleeds happiness overall for most people. That's just my 2 cents. It gets a lot of good, positive attention
happiness.
As opposed to negative.
Well, yes. Mine just bleeds oil.
Attention. Yeah, I don't have that problem yet, but so, I have heard about it.
Yet. So what do you think about the driving experience? Like, how do you like the 911 compared to the M5 now that you've spent a bunch of time with it?
Okay, so they are within 1 year of each other, right?
Yep.
The 911 feels like it is quite literally 30 years older. It's unbelievably ancient in terms of like fit and finish, technology, like what was available to you at the time. The E28 chassis, in comparison, was only around since like 1980, 1981, maybe. So it only has like 8 years on it, Whereas like this 911 chassis was probably around for, I guess since like 74, but really like 60s, they didn't really change much. So like you put your hands under the dash, there's like a clump of wires. You put your hands under the dash of the M5, there's like a nice leather kick panel, right? You peel up the carpet, there's like 19 layers of foam in the M5 and like all these mats. You peel up the mat in the Porsche and it's just metal with a bunch of overspray. So it's a very like old car by comparison, in my opinion.
Those two things aren't necessarily better than the other one, though. I mean, it's just different, right? Those two things.
Just the one's minimalist. Yeah.
It's very minimalist.
Race car. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, here's the deal. This is going to be like the least nerdy or maybe the most nerdy thing. Like things I care about or like that I've noticed that sort of like piqued my interest is incredibly good gas mileage. Very noisy on the highway, right? Like a lot of road noise, a lot of wind noise. Like it's a very small car. So I drive it all the time to go get like groceries and stuff because like it's honestly really convenient. I can park in all the tiny
you
spaces
said
and
small,
nobody gets me.
And yet you're getting groceries in it. So either you don't consume many groceries, but
I go once a week. You know what I mean? Coffee is my only grocery. The other thing too on the grocery thing is there's zero trunk space. Like there is absolutely
right.
You could probably carry one suitcase and I don't know a gallon of milk in the passenger seat. There's nothing else to put in that car.
It's tough because like the trunk
are you opening
shaped?
The right trunk because there's a motor where the trunk should be, Austin. Like maybe you just didn't go to
when you open the hood for the frunk, it's shaped so weirdly that it slants down. So anything you set in the trunk, as soon as you hit the brakes, it slides all the way down the trunk and ends up in front of the spare tire. It's a terrible trunk. It's very not useful unless it's if you fill it all the way up, which is what I do. I just put bags and you know I put a blanket in there if I need to fix something that breaks, and then it's okay because it's all like packed like a can of sardines. But it's really a terrible, terrible trunk. It's absolutely useless.
Yeah, I agree with that. You have to be at 95% capacity or nothing because everything in between is just turns into a broken Lego set. It's unreal. But great car. I like
it. Does yours have air conditioning?
It does have air conditioning.
Does it work?
It works phenomenally, but
wait,
it's gonna be better.
Is this because okay? So you haven't worked your magic yet.
So we haven't done anything yet on the Porsche side. I mostly bought the car. Oh, sorry.
No, I was gonna say this is a perfect like. I'm just gonna segue right in because for those that are not in the know, Austin is the originator of AC Solutions, the latest partner on the podcast. So AC Solutions. Yeah. Offers complete plug-and-play air conditioning conversion kits for your classic BMW, the E30, the E28, E24, and as we're talking about right now, soon to be Porsche, right? So this is why you bought this car, essentially, is like the development mule. So you can get AC Solutions equipment and stay cool all summer long. You guys have OEM quality components, period-correct finishes and materials, so everything fits in correctly as it should.
Jake, I would like to just point out...
upgrade. What?
That's underrated. That's an underrated statement.
Oh, it really is.
The attention to detail.
You don't want to open a hood and something just sticks out as like not
everything's
belonging.
Very, very, very nice. The attention to detail with everything that Austin does with AC Solutions is extremely good. It all looks really expensive to develop.
And it is
from like a manufacturing standpoint. Yeah. It looks like wow, this is some serious development in manufacturing. It's awesome
it seems
stuff.
Very odd to read our advertising notes when you're just here. So I'm going to abbreviate this because, you know, you do have a deep knowledge and passion for these vehicles. Like that shows that's why you bought one of these is to develop it. You've been a car guy and an enthusiast your whole life. And what I love is your user guides are basically like factory service manuals. Like that's what you used as a template to create these. So it's really awesome and easy to put these in. They're all complete with comprehensive warranty, designed, distributed in Northern California. So check them out where? acsolutions.co. Okay, so Austin, you're the expert in air conditioning, and you're perfectly suited then to join me on what this episode will be, is a chilling history, Chris.
Ooh.
The history of air conditioning.
Was the first air conditioning system just like the cold glare of your wife if you got lost? That had to have been like the first, very first system. Because you sent me some old systems and like, those look old. But then there's the picture of the woman in the car and everything.
Yes, absolutely. No, we're going to like, before we get into the nitty gritty of like air conditioning systems and compressors, I'm going to go way back. Like if you've listened to any of these history episodes, we're going to go way off beaten trail and then bring it back. Okay.
I like it. So, I like it.
Yeah. You, Austin, you hail from California, which I assume is not covered in snow and ice, which I still
I don't know, like, dude. Santa Cruz got snow today. They're covered in snow.
Really?
Yeah, really.
That's crazy. Okay, well, we still have cold weather here in Minnesota. And with winter comes the unfortunate side effect of ice, of course. And unfortunately, unless you happen to be one of a man named Frederick Tudor, who was a wealthy blue-blooded New England, circa 1805. See, if you are Frederick, ice is not unfortunate. Sidebar, Austin, how is your impression of a 19th century aristocrat?
I can't say I know one.
Yeah, okay. But can you be one is what he's asking.
You just need to be one here because you see Frederick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who's going to be our protagonist for the first part of this story. Yeah, he was at a summer picnic with his brother enjoying the rare and obscenely expensive luxury of cold beverages and ice cream, as the elite were known to do. The two joked about how their chilled refreshments would be the envy of all the colonists sweating in the West Indies. Oh my, Frederick, can you just imagine how these gold delicacies might go over with those commoners in the West Indies?
So you're basically, like, if you think about this period of time that you're talking about, there are people that had never had a cold drink if it didn't come out of, like, a spring. Like, they've never had a cold drink. They're eating warm or hot food at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Warm or hot food.
Wow.
Yeah. Nothing.
And so here we have these, like, spoiled blue blood brothers up in New England who are just, like, joking, like, can you imagine those commoners? They would lose their minds.
So what are they doing to get back then? And you're probably going to get to this, of course, but I'm sure you'll be able to adapt. But I'm just imagining the huge train cars filled with ice.
Oh, yeah. Just wait. Well, at this point, that wasn't a thing.
Still not a thing.
Transporting ice was not a thing. That's who this guy is. Frederick started the entire ice industry. And that's why I'm talking about Frederick. And it all started with him and his brother being assholes at this picnic, making fun of these, like, plebeians who couldn't afford ice or wouldn't have it, right? Okay. So as condescending as his passing remark was, it stuck with Frederick. And he started to come up with a scheme, which I just love a good scheme. It always makes for a good story. So it's not surprising that our man Frederick was looking for something to get up to. He was basically, by all accounts, just like a loafish rich kid. His father was William Tudor, who was a wealthy Boston lawyer and connections in the upper crust of society. And he had basically arranged for Frederick, this kid, to attend Harvard. But Frederick, to him, that sounded like a lot of work and dreadfully boring. So instead, he retired to his family's country estate, where he spent his days hunting, fishing, and pretending to farm, is what the research I found said.
What is pretend farming?
Well, like, I don't think he actually wanted to do the work, but he, like, wanted to be a country something, so he pretended to farm. I don't know. So with nothing much else going on, Frederick reached out to his older brother, William, to propose a plan. The men would cut blocks of ice out of the pond on the family estate during the winter and ship it to the Caribbean, where it'd be sold for a massive profit, Chris.
What's the loss?
Why, William? Why, William, my dear man, is basically foolproof. Nothing short of printing money. The ice is literally just sitting there. It's free, Chris.
It's free.
You don't have to make it. It's free.
Have you seen the videos of the guys cutting the ice and the stuff out of the lake? It's insane. So, they have these big, huge things, and they pull them out of the water.
Do you have any idea how dangerous that was? I get to it. Because they basically developed this in this entire process. So he was convinced that people, once introduced to the novel concept of ice, would just be hooked and simply couldn't live without it. It would be a necessity from that on. So the brothers pooled all their money together and made plans to ship their product from the French island of Martinique. Is that how you say that one? Martinique. The problem was, everyone thought these brothers were crazy. In fact, they couldn't even find anyone willing to transport the ice. No ship in Boston could even be hired. They literally couldn't find anyone to take their money. That's how ridiculous everyone thought this whole plan was.
Well, so, I'm thinking about, like, it's not these weren't refrigerator ships. These were AC Solutions schooners. Right? I mean, you would think that. Everybody was like, all the ships, it's all going to be melted by the time it gets there. What are you guys doing? You're stupid.
Right.
Basically is what it is.
No problem. these guys have rich dad to fall back on. So they just bought a ship of their own, right? No one wants to ship their ice. They just bought a ship. And so on February 10th, 1806, the Boston Gazette reported, quote, this is in the old newspaper, no joke, explanation point, a vessel with a cargo of 80 tons of ice has cleared out from this port for Martinique. We hope this will not prove to be a slippery speculation. Hey-o. There's a little pun there in the paper. So
that was good.
The folks up in New England thought this whole thing was preposterous. After all, they were surrounded by ice, you know, every year, and no one would ever want to pay for it. That was the collective opinion. But surely, down in the sweltering heat of the Caribbean, it would be the highest of demand.
Here's right. I found a couple of, like, I can't find any, obviously can't find any pictures of this, but this is the scene that someone came up with showing what was actually going on. Getting this ice out of the lake, a bunch of different horses and dudes with sticks and everything else. This looks like quite the operation. It really does.
Yeah.
I mean, that's serious business.
So their first kind of, their first trial at this, they bought a boat, they cut up their ice from like their parents' land basically and shipped it down to the Caribbean. They got down there and they thought they're just going to be like sold out within minutes. Well, when the ice arrived, it did actually arrive in perfect condition. Somehow it did not melt on the way down to the Caribbean.
Oh, come on. There had to have been some sort of loss there.
I'm sure there was some meltage, but
how long does it take to get to Boston from
Martinique? Probably a while.
Yeah,
the problem is it did actually melt once it got down there because no one bought it. It just sat on the boat.
Why?
The locals were not impressed.
Their marketing plan was terrible.
Yeah, well, listen to this. No one seemed to see any need of ice. They've never had it. They've never seen it. And they certainly weren't going to pay money for it. So Frederick, who accompanied his product down to the island, put on his best salesman hat. Although, I need to apologize in advance.
It's 2,000 nautical miles. Depending on the wind conditions, sailing speed, and route taken, a typical sailing vessel could take anywhere from 10 to 20 days, depending on weather.
Okay. So, yeah,
so 10 to
like
20
a
days.
Week and a half.
A week and a half.
3 weeks.
I wonder if these guys would go into the ice room. Like they're like sailing past Bermuda and they're like, man, it's fucking hot. And they just walk downstairs and
go down.
They're just sitting there.
So it was a pleasant journey, if nothing else, if a total loss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want to burn your own supply.
It's true.
Oh, that's the first rule, right?
Right.
So I need to apologize in advance, though, because things are going to get even more off track here for a second. Because
that was fine.
As I said, Frederick, you know, He had to put on his best salesman hat when he realized it wasn't going to sell. And so when I was writing this, I wrote the term salesman's hat figuratively, but then, like, because we've all heard the expression, he wears many hats, referring to the fact a person has many different roles. And this got me wondering, like, where the hell did that phrase come from? And so here we go down the rabbit hole, you guys. Up until the mid-1900s, hats weren't just a fashion accessory. They were a necessity. No self-respecting man would ever be seen in public with a bare head, right? And there was, in fact, different hats for different jobs. Much of it came from not only function, as in, you know, a hard hat is obvious for its purpose, but it was a social identifier of sorts. So, for example, the top hat, which is typically made of silk, was an expensive indulgence of the rich, which would have been perfectly suited, probably, for our character Frederick here.
Well, that's why they call it the man of many hats. A hat is a role. It's your job. So if you do a lot of different things, you're a man of many hats.
Yes. So when going out to peddle ice to the everyman, though, you certainly don't want to be resented. So you would adopt the ubiquitous de facto hat of the working class at the time, not a top hat, the classic flat cap, a.k.a. like the driving hat or what's made famous in the show Peaky Blinders.
Peaky Blinders.
I've never seen it.
It's okay. It's not the best.
Yeah. Yeah. So that cap was indeed also seen as a sort of uniform, not only for a working class laborer, but also for a salesman. Thanks to the spread of the advent of the newsboys, right? So picture the kid with a stack of newspapers shouting in a busy street corner, extra, extra, read all about it. The hat on his head would always be the flat cap, right? And so we can only imagine that Frederick Tudor, as he set up to promote the merits of frozen water, he just may have donned his flat cap, the official cap of the salesman at the time.
There they are. Look at these guys. Look at these dudes right here. There's all flat caps, all with their newspapers.
See?
You know, my buddy and I, he had a newspaper route, and it was like It was fake newspapers. So it was just kind of like this little like local Gazette thing. It wasn't real. Yeah, it was. They had ads in them and like stuff
the
like
Onion
that.
Or something.
Yeah, me too.
That's just like you used to be able to get hard copies of the Onion. Legit.
Yeah, I know. I remember that.
But anyway, so we'd bike over to the place. He had a big sack with like an orange reflective thing on it because we were on bikes, and we'd fill up his thing full of newspapers. We would bike about 2 blocks, and then we would take all the newspapers and just hook them into a dumpster, and then go do other things for the rest of the day.
Wow,
that lasted for an entire summer. Entire summer, we just hucked the newspapers into the trash can.
The poor trash guy who's like
wasn't my job. I was just hanging out. I wasn't the one. I feel like I would have delivered the newspapers. I feel like I would have followed through.
You didn't.
It wasn't my job. I wasn't getting paid. I didn't even get paid to throw them in the dumpster. I just got. There's no guilt by association at 13.
Oh, all right. Well, regardless, that is the story of the newscap. And before we get on any further, let's talk a little bit about another sponsor, CSF Cooling, who's always been at the forefront of quality products for a fair price with a rich history stretching over 7 decades. They provide the best high performance and OEM plus cooling systems on the market. CSF offers over 3,000 different systems, and they offer cooling applications for the most popular makes and models on the road today, from your classic copper brass radiators for Land Cruisers, Jeeps, and Datsuns to vintage 80s Mercedes.
I've got a copper
BMW.
Brass one is what they sent me for the Mercedes. It's pretty nice.
Well, yeah, and Audi, Porsche platforms, of course, all the way up to new vehicles. They have their expanding classic series lineup. Be sure to check them out at csfrace.com or on social media. Okay, so back to our story here, and I promise it is going to come back to being relevant to what we're actually here to talk about. But
I hope it doesn't, because this is great.
Do you like this? Okay.
Yeah,
well,
great.
Our friend Frederick, you know, he's down on the island.
What's this guy's name? Frederick? I want to see what he looks like. Frederick.
Tudor.
Frederick. Tudor.
Yes.
All right, let's see what. Ooh. Oh, look at this guy. Oh, yeah. Hold on.
I'm really sad. I don't know why I can't see the screen when you share it now, but it makes me sad.
Can you see it, Austin, when I share the screen?
No, I don't see it.
Oh, that's too bad.
See?
Everybody else
We don't
can,
get
though.
To see anything. All right. Well, anyways.
This is
Frederick,
him right here.
He's desperately trying to recoup all of the money he lost down in the Caribbean. And he's trying to explain how these cold blocks of ice could be used in the stifling heat. You know, islanders basically paid him no mind. Well, now I can't see you at all. Are you guys still there?
Yeah, we're still here. Keep going.
You just turned off cameras. Now this is just confusing. All right.
I did not
do
that, but keep going.
He really must have been desperate. Unlike other products, ice sitting in the hull of a boat, smack dab on the equator, has a very short shelf life, I would imagine. And so Frederick's venture was a dismal failure, with all of his invested money literally melting away. And unsurprisingly, Frederick's brother, William, who was kind of like in on the deal with him, completely pulled out. But Frederick himself wasn't deterred. The next winter, he was back at it. He has his product again. It's winter. It's in Boston. They got ice. He's back at it. Having a circle of rich friends apparently has its merits. And remarkably, he scrounged up enough money to send yet another shipment of ice down to the West Indies. But when a trade embargo left much of the Caribbean off limits for 2 years, Frederick was left twiddling his thumbs. And
what do you do then?
How
are they enforcing this? How are they enforcing this trade embargo?
All right, probably a blockade. Haven't you seen the movie 13 Days?
Yeah, that's what we have. Yeah, but we have U2 planes flying around during that time. There's those U2 planes trying to find out if Frederick Tudor's bringing ice to Martinique.
Well, it certainly didn't work. Meanwhile, the Tudor family, so Frederick's parents, their fortune had dwindled in a shady real estate deal in South Boston. So apparently the rest of the family wasn't any more business savvy than poor Frederick either. Add to that a whole series of circumstances, none the least of which included the War of 1812, and things were looking pretty grim for his business. And yet, despite financial woes and multiple failures, Frederick, out of either sheer stupidity or sheer brilliance, he persisted. Over the course of the next decade, he tried as many gimmicks and ploys as he could come up with to convince folks that they actually needed ice. Basically, he just ended up giving away his entire supply of ice. By the time 1819 came around, he had become as poor as the commoners.
Do we know what he was charging? How much is
nothing
ice?
Nothing yet.
He's just trying to give it away.
He's literally giving it away to create interest and demand. This is a product that no one had ever thought to sell or buy before.
Okay.
So by the time 1819 came around, he had become as poor as the commoners that he and a brother had earlier made fun of, right? So he moved to South Carolina, where he lived in a boarding house. And even while slumming it with this working class, he still continued to peddle his wares, making a habit of bringing a cooler of chilled beverages to the dinner table each night. And his housemates, who always scoffed at the sight, soon, after a sip or two, did indeed grow accustomed to the nice cold beverage.
What do you think it cost to sail 2,000 nautical miles, Jake, in 1899?
In 1800?
Yeah,
1899. Okay, we're in 1820s here.
Let's 1800s.
I have no idea.
The estimated cost in today's dollars, if you wanted to make that trip, just the one trip, just to get down there, was $60,000 in today's dollars. Plus the cost of the ship, too. So you got the cost of the ship, and you got the cost to get the ice out of the water, transport the ice to the thing. So this is probably like a $100,000 operation that he's just...
It's actually not bad. $60,000?
That's just to get there. That doesn't include like getting the ice out of the water. It doesn't include the rail car to get the water.
So I can make my AC systems ship them to the Caribbean. You're telling me.
Wait, I have a new idea. That's funny. No fuel cost, though. Save money on fuel.
All right, so rather than trying to ship ice down to the Caribbean this time, Frederick is just traveling around the mainland U.S. He's visiting each bar, tavern, and saloon he came across, convincing barkeeps to offer drinks with ice at no extra charge. He's just trying to get the concept out there that, like, look, ice is cool.
Can you imagine having scotch with ice for the first time? Like, with an ice cube?
Although, honestly, you wouldn't be used to it, so you'd probably be like, turned off a little bit. I don't know what the what is the take rate, or like, is there like a ramping up? Do you have to get used to it, right? Do you have to get accustomed to ice?
I don't think so. It's just water. It's not like you're using frozen lemonade and putting it near scotch or something. It's just water.
Actually, Austin, that sounds really good too. You're right, like if you live in the north. No, but to his point, like you've had cold drinks before. This is, and that's why he's traveling down in the south, right? They didn't get winter. They haven't, like, I'm sure people have had ice before, but it wasn't
a
common thing.
Yeah, but all beer is warm. Beer is all served warm. All this stuff is all served warm. So I'm just saying, like, having scotch for the first time with an ice cube, which...
It'd be great.
Brings out the flavor, right?
It changes the flavor profile, if you want to get technical.
True.
No comment.
Yeah, we'll call it that.
Okay. Frederick also gave seminars at restaurants, teaching them how to make the delectable and novel treat called ice cream. Because again, no ice, there was no ice cream. And so he's like, look, you guys could sell this. He even started pitching doctors and hospitals the ice was the perfect way to treat fevers. So he's finding like every single avenue to try to sell ice. And to his credit, his unwavering efforts started to work. By 1821, Frederick had created demand for his product in cities across the South. Savannah, Charleston, New Orleans, and even Havana. They all wanted to start buying this ice. So Mr. Tudor finally had a market for his ice. But now, he had another problem. His current method of supply, namely cutting blocks out of frozen ponds on his family's estate up north, was hardly scalable. And by the time he was able to get it shipped out, left virtually zero profit. So there wasn't scale involved. He finally has a market, and now he can't really supply it. Enter one Nathaniel Wyeth, a young innovator who would later go on to become a famous engineer.
This is actually Austin's great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Yes,
I've heard. No, I wish, guys. I wouldn't be here if that's the case. You go, no.
So Nathaniel Wyeth, this dude's innovations include improvements to manufacturing processes, developments in the fields of textiles, electronics, and mechanical devices, and most notably, the invention of the plastic polymer that is used in every single carbonated beverage bottle today. Or so I thought.
The one that's poisoning everybody, right?
Or so I thought. Because when I was looking up this Nathaniel guy, I realized that if he had worked with Frederick back in 1820, he would be nearly like 200 years old by the time he developed these other inventions I just listed. So, it turns out,
Jake?
I found this fascinating, so I included it. There's two different notable inventors by the name of Nathaniel Wyeth. So the guy we're actually talking about was known for just this, refining and harvesting of ice commercially. So he became Frederick's foreman in 1826 and found that the ice on frozen rivers could be cut into large grids using a horse-drawn plow. He then instituted a process similar to that of logging in that industry in the day. Laborers sawed these frozen blocks apart and floated them over to the open water where the river currents didn't let the ice freeze. Downstream, the ice was then pushed onto a conveyor belt, which would hoist the blocks up from the water and carry them up to insulated ice houses where they'd be stacked up to 80 blocks high.
What?
No, 80 feet high. Okay. Still very tall.
Well, that's even higher technically, thinking about how was this guy like a logging guy? Was he into the logging industry? Because this seems very, very akin to dropping the logs in the river.
Right.
And
so honestly, the analogy of the logging thing never came up in my research, but as I'm looking at it, I'm like, this is what they do for logging.
It's 100%
logging. Thinking he looked at that industry and he's like, oh, well, let's just cut them out here and then move them over to the open water and float them down.
Do you think the other guy, Mr. Martinique, adventure guy, was just like, mother, you're like, why didn't I think of that?
Wait, who's Martinique?
The Martinique guy. I already forgot his name. Frederick.
Oh, Frederick. Yes.
Frederick guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He's his partner. He just came on as like his partner. So he's we're doing it.
But okay. So I gotcha.
Even with these improvements and larger scale operations, only 1 in 10 blocks of ice ever made it to sail because it melts. As we talked about. So your right. shrinkage in your like whole supply chain is 90%. Yeah, damn it. I knew that was coming. So what's worse than that, though, the whole operation was incredibly dangerous. Turns out that slippery blocks of ice that weigh over 300 pounds each, stacked 8 stories high, makes for dangerous working conditions. Not to mention working on deadly frigid water with massive sharp saws and frostbit hands. Like, it was not ideal. Thankfully, Frederick and Mr. Wyeth, thankfully for them, OSHA didn't exist.
They didn't have Thinsulate or North.
No, they probably had like deer
skin. Provide them. North Face should have sponsored them and given them stuff. I mean, okay, and then they should have posted. Look at this. They could have been doing selfies, getting the ice blocks out of the water. Ooh, with North Face or Patagonia like jackets on.
Organic marketing.
And then it could have covered some of their costs.
100%.
Yeah, that's true.
They needed an influencer, Jake.
Oh, they needed an influencer. The dawn of the influencer. but it's like the old style camera with like the phosphate flash, you know?
Yes.
And the guy that goes.
And
he's
the
like,
guy
yeah.
just holding the block of ice, just like.
He's got icicles.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because you have to sit there. I love it. Yeah. So hugely dangerous. OSHA didn't exist. So the operation is actually working. In 1833, Frederick's reputation was solidified. Do you see what I did there? You're not catching any of the puns that
solidified?
I'm
solidified?
Like,
That's not a good pun.
Ice solidifies. Ice is solidified
so
water.
Jello.
Come on, Chris. All right.
His status as the Iceman is frozen in time at that point in history. That's a good one. Saying it's solidified is garbage.
That was much better, actually. his reputation was absolutely frozen in time when he shipped 180 tons of ice halfway across the world to British colonists in Calcutta. Which I don't even know where Calcutta is, to be honest, you guys. The venture was so successful that it actually served to reopen trade routes between India and Boston. Oh, is it in India? Calcutta's in India.
Yeah,
that
India.
Makes sense now.
Yeah.
Okay. Frederick became known around the world as the Ice King. Not the Ice Man, Chris. The Ice King. An industrial baron of an entire industry that he made on his own. By 1947...
Great.
Nearly 52,000 tons of ice traveled by ship or train to 28 cities across the United States. Nearly half of the ice came from Boston, most of which was all Frederick Tudor's. He died in 1864 and was finally wealthy
once again. Was he packed in ice? Did they pack him in ice?
I don't know why you would,
in
Chris.
His coffin?
I don't know why you would.
It's symbolic.
I don't think they
it's
did.
Symbolic.
I'm not,
if
no,
I was the
no,
ice king, I would want to be packed with ice.
Yeah, maybe. I guess. What? Okay. Well, anyways, by that time, everyone with access to a frozen body of water was in on the action.
Or this a frozen body. Because they this packed was the it ice with ice. Boom.
Yeah, just like that. No, but he basically created this entire industry. He became rich off of it and created an entire boom. So these, and just like the railroad boom, you know, where they had like these little, what do they call the towns that popped up around the industry?
Boom towns.
Okay, yeah, boom towns. Well, there was ice boom towns that sprouted up all along the Kennebec River in Maine, where farmers found your own employment. Like if you're farming in the summer and you don't have anything to do but try to survive in the winter, now all of a sudden there's an entire industry that you can work at.
And so these are... They're just basically delivering. At this point, you had a cellar underneath. Before this.
Correct.
You had a cellar underneath your house where you put like produce and stuff like that. And you would dry meat down there and stuff like that.
Yeah.
As you get into the 1800s, now cabinet makers,
ice box.
Carpenters, whatever, are making ice boxes for your ice that then exists 100%. probably still in your cellar. But you, the ice guy comes by on his little thing, his little horse.
There was
his
the
little
ice, guy.
Ice buggy. And he goes... And
like
he's
the
probably
man,
like
the
cousins with the milkman. Why is the comparison that you're an illegitimate child
with
stuck
the milkman,
to the milkman?
But
why
not
isn't
the
ice
man? Ice
man?
Because
he's way cooler.
It's too cold, Chris. Too much shrinkage. It couldn't have worked.
It's true. There's a lot of shrinkage.
There you go. Yeah.
Wendy was not interested in the ice man. It just wasn't hers. She wasn't into it.
So
it looks all shriveled up.
Yeah, no, that's not gonna work. American society grew more accustomed to fresh meats, milk, fruit. The ice industry expanded into one of the most powerful industries in the nation at the time. At the turn of the 20th century, every family, grocer, and barkeep in America had an ice box, just like we talked about. But ironically, America's dependence on ice created the very technology that would lead to the industry's death. In 1914, engineer Nathaniel B. Wales of Detroit introduced the idea for a practical electrified refrigeration unit. It was a self-contained refrigerator made up of a compressor.
Jake.
Yep, go ahead.
We've skipped over dry ice a little bit. Like, I know dry ice was invented in the 1800s at some point, but was it just not able to be mass-produced at that point? Because right now, you can just go buy dry ice.
I think it's expensive.
But I could go buy it at the gas station, can't you?
Yeah, you can buy a lot of things at the gas station that you couldn't in 1820.
It's true.
Terrible comparison.
Well, I just, you'd think that maybe Nathaniel, or not Nathaniel, but Frederick would have tried to compress the carbon dioxide.
He wasn't a scientist. He was just a rich kid who had ice in his backyard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's so much easier to get rich back then. Right? So
much
easier to get rich. Maybe? Is it?
What do you have to do, Austin?
Well, there's no
well,
crypto.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously it was.
Yeah.
So let's see. How does artificial refrigeration actually take place? Well, in 1918, the concept was brought out by one William Durant, who started the Frigidaire Company. And that's when household refrigerators and freezers really took off. The science of it, though, as I'm sure Austin knows all about, it dates back to 1755. So Scottish professor William Cullen discovered that by creating a vacuum over a container of certain liquids, in this case diethyl ether, the liquid would boil and absorb heat from its surroundings. The basic concept of using pressure differences in various chemicals to create a change in temperature is the basis for all refrigeration and air conditioning systems even today. And over the years, scientists refined the process. In 1820, there was a British scientist, Michael Faraday, which I think is probably the same Faraday that did the Faraday cage and all the experiments with electricity. He used the liquefied ammonia, which
unless
your
Michael Faraday was born 200 years later and invented Mountain Dew or something.
Apparently that could have been a thing. In 1856, a Scottish-Australian scientist by the name of James Harrison filed a patent for a closed-system vapor compression system using ether, alcohol, and ammonia. He built a mechanical ice-making machine in 1851, and I only included him in the story because I'd like to imagine what a Scottish-Australian accent would sound like.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Let's hear it.
Is it? Okay, so like Sean Connery, you talk like this a little bit and you're Scottish, but then you're down in Australia, you see, maybe, look here, his newfangled machine is ice from electricity. That was it.
Send all complaints to Jake at overcrestproductions.com. If you are Scottish, we do have Scottish listeners and we do have Welsh listeners.
Yeah,
I'm sure
but
they're going to.
I doubt we have a Scottish-Australian.
We have a lot of Australian customers, Jake. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, but are they Scottish Australian?
They're Scottstralians.
Scottstralians. Yeah, I think that's even more offensive.
Or Oscots.
Oscots. That's better. Okay, well, you know what isn't offensive is Petrobox. It's a monthly service made especially for the automotive enthusiast. Each month, they carefully select items, including tools, detailing supplies, apparel, garage gear, stickers, and publications to be sent right there to your doorstep, whether you're in Scotland or Australia. It's a curated selection of the latest and greatest gear in the industry. There's two different levels to choose from. Petrobox Basic costs less than $20 a month, while the Petrobox Premium gets you even more gear for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrobox.com. You can use Overcrest. That'll give you a discount on your first order. Austin, have you ever been gifted or received a Petrobox?
I have not.
Okay.
It's funny.
Maybe we'll have to figure out a way to make that happen. All right. So back to refrigeration. It was really the advent of the General Electric monitor top refrigerator that kicked things off. Introduced in 1927, over a million units were sold in the U.S. But Chris, here's the thing. These machines used
how much
either,
were they?
I have it here somewhere. Oh, where did I put that?
They had to have been ridiculously expensive. I mean, holy crap, right?
Yeah. Well, they sold a million. So it's like...
Well, what was the population in the United
States? The '20s, too, keep in mind, was like the boom area, right? Like the Great Depression hadn't happened, stock market hadn't collapsed. The problem with them wasn't the price. The problem was they used either sulfur dioxide, which is corrosive to the eyes and causes blindness, painful skin burns, and lesions, or they used methyl formate, which is highly explosive and toxic if inhaled. So
they were $4,500 to $15,000 in today's money, adjusting for inflation.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's you could spend that much on like a high-end appliance today.
They required regular maintenance and were not. Yeah, but you could also get a refrigerator for like $100
on Craigslist.
Best Buy outlet. Like you can go get one right now.
Back then.
You know what's crazy is there's a cold spot. I don't know what brand this is or anything. There's a cold spot refrigerator in my grandpa's basement. And it might be a GE, but it has
cold
a big,
spot? Why is that what it's called?
It's called the cold spot. That's just what it's called. It says cold spot on it. It's kind of round.
I don't think anyone knew that reference. You were like, there's a cold spot.
Like there's a cold spot.
I was thinking like in the house there was a cold spot, like it was a poltergeist
just
or
a
something.
Shelf in the basement.
Like you're just cold and you're like they're I don't know.
No, it's just a spot in the basement where it's just colder. No, so it's this big, it's a GE cold spot or something like that, refrigerator, freezer, whatever.
Yeah.
It's got big handle, like a chunk. And there's no way, like if you put a child in there, they're dead. There's no way to get out.
Yeah,
it's a big
that latch. Actually happened a lot.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. There's no way to get out. And it's
the latch is a lock.
It's a lock and it pulls itself and seals it. That thing still works to this day. That thing has got it's got orange juice in there and eggs and all kinds of stuff that you would like to keep cold.
Austin's
in this
Googling
ancient,
cold
I
spot.
Don't understand. Like
I had to Google it.
You see it?
Who makes it?
It looks nice. Good place for some beer.
Is that a General Electric product or what is that?
Yeah.
I see. That's my good old memory right there.
So the first General Electric refrigerator, the monitor top, it sold amazing.
Yeah, there it is.
But it had terrible chemicals in it, either sulfur
Jake's
dioxide
frozen.
Again, which blinds you, or the explosive methyl formate, which is toxic if inhaled. So yeah, young Jimmy here, he went blind last year from a refrigerator, but god darn it, Martha, it sure is worth it to have cold beer in the house, isn't it? It was not safe stuff. And it turns out that Frigidaire, who was a wholly owned subsidiary of General Motors by the late 1920s. So seeing, or in the case of our poor little Jimmy there, not seeing a problem with the state of chemicals in the industry, he established a research team to find a replacement, a chemical they branded as Freon. This was General Motors, or not, yeah,
General
Motors.
Sounds like a chlorofluorocarbon, if I've ever heard of one.
It is, Chris, and we're going to get there. So, technically known as dichlorodifluoromethane, or simply R12, it provided a completely safe, low-toxic alternative.
That's
but it wasn't
great
just,
to hear, because I've inhaled that stuff on multiple occasions.
Yeah, no, it's like, much better than the stuff that
times.
Makes you blind.
Yeah, it's...
It wasn't just refrigerators that were making use of this new cooling technology, though. Soon, people realized the luxury of keeping their entire house cool during sweltering summer heat. And they certainly were a luxury. In 1932, window ledge air conditioning units went on sale. Do you guys care to venture the price? Don't look it up yet.
Okay.
This is 1932.
And I'm imagining the 20s and 30s.
Yep.
And 20s, 30s, 40s. And even into the 40s and 50s, when you're driving along the freeway, one of the biggest ads you would see is refrigerated air, cold Coca-Cola, all these things. It's like cold air, refrigerated air, ice cold lobby, all this stuff. So I'm thinking if these signs were still going up in neon in the 50s, this was really expensive in the 30s. Really expensive.
Okay. What's your, I want a price, a shot in the dark from each
year. In today's dollars, I'm going to go for a window air conditioning unit with probably 7.4 BTUs. Yes. I'm guessing they're not very efficient back then.
Is that how you measure cooling? Austin is still BTU? Because that seems backwards.
BTU is like the volume. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to go $6,500 in today's dollars.
Probably going to go for five. So Chris overpaid.
You guys, the actual price, not adjusted, the actual price in 1932 started at $10,000 and ranged up to $50,000 in 1932 during the Great Depression.
Wow.
That's equivalent to $200,000 to well over $1 million in today's money. Like, this was the most luxurious thing. I can't imagine they sold a lot of them. But even so, this is America, ladies and gentlemen. If we are known for anything, it might as well be over-the-top luxury features in our homes and cars. And so it wasn't long before air conditioning units found their way into production vehicles. In 1940, Packard offered in all its models the option of the Bischoff and Badcock weather conditioner. Chris, do you want to pull up some imagery of the...
I do, but I want to make one point.
Okay.
And, you know, we think this is kind of like for comfort, right? And we think about air conditioning as being like, oh, it's nice. It's comfortable.
It's a luxury.
Air conditioning has saved tens to hundreds of thousands of lives.
From
heat stroke, exhaustion, everything. But it's anytime you see,
mostly
anytime
like
you see power outages, people die. They're dying because it's too freaking hot. You're 85, 90 years old.
Yeah, you're old people.
Yeah, you're dying without air conditioning. Air conditioning saves lives, Austin.
Yeah, but like,
it really does.
Do you know that every year, I think. Go ahead. I was going
to
make a dumb argument.
Every year, I think we lose 5 to 10,000 E30 enthusiasts just to lack of air conditioning. It's really sad.
Thank you for making that lighthearted. Let me pull this up. That.
Go ahead, Jake.
Okay, so 1940. This is 1940, the Packard models. They had the Bischoff and Badcock weather conditioner. Now I can see imagery. This is awesome. So cars opened as such were shipped from Packard's facility to the B&B factory, where they then had the systems installed. It consisted of an engine-driven external pump assembly, which we're seeing right there, and the main evaporator and blower system, which took up more than half of the space in the trunk. Which I don't think I have a picture of just that back system. Actually, there is. If you go down to that third photo there,
it's right there. Look at that thing.
It takes up just like the entire trunk space. Ooh, but look at that nice diagram. Oh, yeah. See, you make your wife ride in the back, Chris.
I was going to say that. What I'm seeing right here is I'm seeing her attitude being recirculated into her own face. If you look at the image right there, everything she's saying doesn't even reach the man. It just bounces off the
seat. It probably was noisy, wasn't it? Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I like the trunk picture.
She could be getting chauffeured too.
No, yeah, she could. But
just saying.
No, if you have a chauffeur, Packard, Austin, that's for the 180 of the house.
Oh,
that
fair,
is
yeah,
a
I would
good
never let my wife
looking,
that.
Good looking car.
What is this one, Jake?
Which one? I think that's a later photo, but I just loved it, so I
it
included it.
It is phenomenal. Look at this.
That well, looks
she
more.
Is. She is something else.
Wow, you I mean, that, this is Chris? This, that's doing it for you.
Well, not anymore. She's probably 97 years old, so I'm not super into it. But I think she looks really nice. She got the little gloves on.
She's a very nice lady. She's a
very nice lady.
Don't know what you want from me on that one. All right, so cars option.
Non-inflation adjusted. Looks good.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
like
exactly.
That. In today's Yeah, no. Cars optioned as such were shipped from Packard's facility. I already read that. The price, though, of these was not nearly as ridiculous as the early in-home units. It was $274, which adjusted is just over $6,000 in today's money. That was still like pretty far out of reach for most like Depression era Americans, though, to option on top of the price of a car. So it wasn't until the next few decades, really, as technology advanced and became both more affordable and compact, that it became increasingly common. By the year 1969, more than half of all new vehicles sold in the U.S. were equipped with air conditioning. Which actually
everybody's
surprised
car, their houses didn't have air conditioning.
Right.
Their cars
over half of all cars, wow, even in 69, had air conditioning. The basic mechanics of cooling systems, being a refrigerator or AC unit, haven't really changed much over the years, except for one key element, Freon. In 1976, the National Academies of Science issued a damaging report. Recent studies had showed that widespread use of certain chemicals classified as chlorofluorocarbons had a damaging and permanent effect on the Earth's atmosphere. These chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, included most aerosol propellants used in spray cans, everything from hairspray to spray paint, as well as Freon, the chemical used in all of these cooling devices. The actual damage was attributed to how these chemicals interacted with the ozone layer found in our atmosphere. Ozone, which is naturally a type of occurring molecule comprised of three oxygen atoms, is found in the upper stratosphere, where it acts to absorb most of the sun's harmful ultraviolet radiation. So when these CFCs get released, they travel up to the upper reaches of the atmosphere and create a chemical reaction with the ozone molecules, breaking them down into just run-of-the-mill O2, which is not able to filter out UV rays. So this report found that if the chemicals continued to be used and released, the Earth would basically turn into a giant microwave, which is not good. As
it doesn't
such,
sound great.
No, it really isn't. In 1987 is when the Montreal Protocol was established, which sounds like the latest Mission Impossible film, but it's actually just the international agreement banning the use and production of CFCs such as R12.
Well, that, I think that hole in the ozone has recovered largely.
Not fully, but largely. That could very well be. I didn't dig too much further into it. The problem is what these scientists found is that for every like molecule or two of these CFCs going up, it created a chain reaction. It wasn't just like a 1-to-1 ratio of like any fluorocarbon going up would destroy that much ozone. It was like thousands of times bigger than whatever was released. So there was a big concern.
Jake.
Yeah.
I have an ozone machine. I have a machine that just makes ozone. What are we doing?
Let's just turn them all on. We're good to go.
Where is it? It's like a little black box. You plug it in and it's an ozone machine.
For what?
For like you put it in your car and it takes all of the smell out. If you have like a bad smell or in your house, in a room, the thing is it's extremely poisonous. You can't breathe it. But why don't we just make a giant ozone machine?
We can make an ozone blimp.
The Goodyear ozone like blimp. I mean, that sounds really, really green. That sounds.
I think. All right. So what we're hearing is bring back R12, basically eliminate all of Austin's business overnight. And
yes. Yeah, I don't know about that part.
Are we? Can we talk for a second about the difference? Are you gonna? You're obviously gonna go into R134. Correct.
I am here in a little bit, and I'm actually just going to turn it over to Austin here in a little bit, to be completely honest.
Okay.
So
I want to know the difference between R12 and R134.
Yes.
And because one thing that I always do is I have like my Trooper right here, this thing. When I got this thing, AC didn't work. And it's an R12 truck. And I'm not going to go and find a conversion kit and install all this shit, mainly because I was planning on yanking the motor out anyway. If I wasn't, maybe I would have thought about doing it correctly. The first thing I did is I went to AutoZone, got the little thing, or O'Reilly or whatever your choice is, and I just pumped R134 in there. All summer, AC worked great. So what's happening? Like, why do people need to convert? Like, why do we need to convert from R12 to R134? Why doesn't everybody just pound that shit in there like I do on all my shit boxes? I'm serious. The red Mercedes that I dragged out of the freaking field that I've been sitting there for 15 years, pounded R134 in there, worked great. The brown Mercedes that I drove around Oregon,
How long do you own these cars? Have you ever used it for more than one season?
Thank you, Jake.
What else do you need? Austin. It's only like 20 bucks. Need one.
Oh, yeah. They're just disposable
systems.
So if
you're going to replace this stuff anyway, why not just pound the R134
the
in there until it breaks and then convert it?
The dryer, all of it. Yeah, okay, just disposable
items. That is my
question.
Is it damaging to those things?
So if you're comparing like a 30-year-old system, right, that's already theoretically spent, right? It's already worn out. It's already used. You can just keep shoving new Freon into it, whether it's R12, R134A, R12A. There's a bunch of different, you know, variants and hybrids of that. You can do that all day long. But I guarantee you it's not going to last much longer than 1 year, or let alone one summer season. So if you then think about the scenario of comparing a like perfectly working R12 system, right, where you have a new R12 compressor, new R12 O-rings, new R12 lines, you know, all the new R12 like expansion valves and dryers and all the fun stuff, all that's replaced. And then you shove R134 in there, probably going to be okay. But it's mostly due to the age of the system.
Gotcha.
So obviously not to tangent super hard into like what we do, but
no,
people
this
are
is, this
coming
is
to
time.
Us with the, well, perfect. So then why don't I just go for it? So
okay.
People come to us with the issue of old components not working, right? And it's not one or two things usually. It's usually 5 to 15 things, right? Oh, I have the old expansion valve. Oh, it's leaking in the interior lines. Oh, my hose has a little cut in it. I can see the fluid pouring out, right? The little green dye, things like that. You're basically at the point where you need to redo everything. So you can take an old engine, you can put new oil into it, but at some point in time, it's probably going to need rings. It's probably going to need bearings. It's probably going to need chain guides, all the fun stuff. So it can still last. You can still go to Jiffy Lube or whatever and do an oil change and hope for the best, or go to O'Reilly, like you're saying with the air conditioning stuff, and just grab a little can of R134A and it might be okay until it isn't.
So it's, but so what you're saying is it's not damaging the system. You're just putting it in a system that's already on its last legs.
That's not entirely true, because of lubrication.
Not totally true. Exactly. Dang, Jake is on it. So there's two different types of oil. There's basically an ester oil and a PAG oil, and they're different chemical compositions and they don't really work together. And there's also mineral oil, which is what is used for R12 lubrication, which definitely does not work with R134A. It basically froths up, and then you get into compressor failures. You get into high pressure zones where there's blockages, right? Could be like dirt in the system. And then you go from a summer of nice AC with your $14 AutoZone can to, I need a new compressor. I need the lines. I broke all the switches. And now you have a whole project in your hands. So
right.
Back to you, Jake.
No, I'm setting them up for you. Here you go.
It's okay. I like these.
I've never experienced that. I've done this so many times, but like you guys said, I don't keep anything long enough.
That's just
for
it
to even really matter. I just pound the stuff in there and go, holy shit, this is amazing. I have air conditioning. It's 100 degrees outside and I don't care because I can have air conditioning right now versus like, you know, all the process of fitting all the air conditioning on a stuff that I on a car I'm going to keep for about 35 more seconds.
Yep. That's the difference, really. I mean, that's probably the biggest differentiator, which is why you always see cars that go for sale that are like, oh, just needs a recharge. I'm like, well, I bet it doesn't, because if it did, you probably would have done it.
Right, so, exactly. Why didn't you do it there, dude? You live in Arizona. Why doesn't it work?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're telling me to just go to AutoZone, why don't you just go to AutoZone?
Yeah.
Tetrafluorethane. Fluorophane? Fluoroethane? Ethane. Tetrafluoroethane. That's what R134A is, by the way. And so that was introduced when R12 got phased out. This is for Chris, because we know Chris loves a good conspiracy theory, because he's kind of scoffed a little bit about the ozone and the outlaw of R12. Chris, put on your tinfoil hat.
That's on.
Do you want to know actually why they outlawed everything and the Montreal Protocol came out?
Probably because somebody's cousin ran the R134 plant. They called
DuPont,
up Senator Bob.
DuPont,
oh, here we
who
go.
Had the patent on R12 Freon as a chemical. The patent was expiring and they were not able, because it had been in patent law so long, they were not able to renew it. So they figured, rather than losing out on all of this money, all this profit, we're going to outlaw it.
So they sent lobbyists to Congress.
They did it. Yep.
Yeah, they started talking, the Sierra
ozone.
Club.
There's no
Wendy
ozone.
Over here at the Sierra Club. Yeah, yeah.
Fake news.
Wendy is now our perpetual female that we reference, Wendy. So anytime we talk
about
it.
That was Wendy in the back seat of the car.
It's Wendy in the back seat of the car. It's Wendy in the front seat with the cute hat on. It's always Wendy forever. So basically Wendy at the Sierra Club, you know, is sleeping with the CEO of DuPont, and he's basically telling her, hey, I need you to push through this thing and lobby for R12 being gone. Is that accurate?
That's exactly what happened. Okay, now take your tinfoil hat off, and we'll get back to actual practical applications and questions for people that want to know about AC. So, in
addition, this is the most interesting thing I've heard about the whole thing yet, is this DuPont conspiracy.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, the DuPont conspiracy. Didn't know that. That's very interesting. Not surprised. This is the same thing,
Jake, that happened. We did the light bulb episode. You remember?
Dude, that was a good one. That
Austin,
is a real...
have you heard about the light bulb conspiracy?
That one's good. I remember listening to that.
I mean, how many things has this happened with that we don't even see? Yeah, but how many things has this happened with that we don't even
know
about?
I brought this one up as like a joke, but you love it. And
the same thing happened with like the railroad tracks. Like some guy owned like this thing, and some guy other owned this width. So this guy, it's kind of, I don't really care as long as my air conditioning works. But if the patent would have expired on R12, how much would a can of R12 cost if you were buying like if you could buy it at the grocery store next to the generic macaroni and cheese that just says macaroni and cheese, ingredients, macaroni, cheese. And it's just like the most generic thing. Right next to that is R12.
Yeah.
It would have been
way $350. Cheaper. That's right.
Now,
it is interesting.
It's $1 million. It's literal gold.
I do Jerry, have a bunch of it in my garage.
So does my grandpa, and he won't give it to me. He won't give it to me. He doesn't even own a car that it goes in. He's just got these cans of R12.
That's one of the last things I have to do to the 944 before I sell it is put that R12 back in it because I got to...
Nah, just tell the guy he needs to charge.
Austin didn't make a kit yet for the 944, so I bought all new old stock like R12 componentry, so it'd just be dialed in.
I'm trying to figure out if there's a market for Austin in like the... The problem with like 944 guys...
I did put green
God
seals
bless
in
them,
it, though. Gone.
They're so cheap.
It's okay.
Those guys are so cheap. Their cars are worthless. 944s. Like,
I hope not.
For Austin, for Austin to make kits, yeah, you better know. Well, you've got a 951, so it's a little bit different. But developing a kit for a car that cost $3,500 if you want to go out and buy one.
Right.
And these guys are like limping them all along.
That was the E30 for a while there, too. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's actually pretty similar to the BMW market. I mean, there's a surprising amount of 944 like interest in our products, right? Which makes sense. And there are a couple other guys out there that currently do the 944 stuff.
Oh,
the biggest challenge
with
944 is the packaging. I mean,
it's
obviously,
so tight.
Jake,
it's
I'm
a
sure
nightmare.
You've seen,
I hate that car so much, Austin. I hate it.
You know what the easiest packaging and the lowest hanging fruit for you, Austin, is?
A
Volkswagen. No. Yeah. No, it's Volkswagen. It's Volkswagen. Like Mark II Volkswagens, Mark III, you know, all these. I mean, they're starting to become cool, but like a GTIs and stuff like that, none of the AC systems work. They don't work.
Yeah.
But it's very simple. It's just a Sanborn compressor thing with the little lines that come out and it makes air cold. It's very simple.
Yep, that's exactly how it works. That's great.
I just went over this. That's not at all how that works.
You're looking very dreamy, Jake, with your lens flare coming through the window.
Thank you.
You look very dreamy. Yeah, look at
thank
that.
Thank you.
Very, very beautiful.
That is a nice lens flare. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
the sun came
out. Nice.
I was going to say something else, and I don't know. Oh, Austin, why else won't R12 or R134 work in R12 systems? The molecule size, right? So that contributes to...
Yep.
Leaks more. So R12, it turns out. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say that's another part of the, you know, the biggest issues, right? Is in an old system, obviously the seals are all dried up, the whole thing's based on like a beadlock style O-ring system, or sometimes it's tube flares, but either way, mostly all O-ring connections. And obviously Freon operates in a closed system at very high pressure. So any and all leaks are essentially detrimental. There's no, you can't have a small coolant leak, for example, in a Freon system. So the Freon size of R134, I think, I don't know the actual percentage amount. You might have it, but it is considerably
smaller. It's 11.7% smaller.
Oh.
Did you make that up or did you look it up?
11.7?
I made that up. I don't know.
Okay, I was going to say, I don't think that's right.
I knew right away. Looked that up.
Dang, I'm too gullible. So it's kind of fun, right? So like if you were to replace all the seals, which you can't even really get the old HRBN, you know, R12 style seals anymore, but you can get all the green seals, which are the R134A equivalent ones, which obviously work for both. In a new R12 system, you'd probably be okay. You'd obviously have to fill it up with the R134A lubricant, and then obviously the R134A itself. But in an old system that's all leaked and cracked, yeah, it's going to come out twice as fast. That's pretty much how that works. Or you'll discover a new leak that you may not have had with your R12, but now you have four or five new leaks with your R134A system, if that makes sense.
Okay, so this is, I have an actual practical question talking about that 951. Yes. That I put all new AC components on, and I'm going to put the R12 that I have in bottles in, but I don't know for sure if it's going to leak or not because I haven't tested it. Could I put the new cheap R134A in the system first, use my leak sniffer to make sure it's not leaking, and then go and put R12? Because R12 also is technically, I hate to say it, it's more efficient of a molecule for the system.
Yeah, well, so R12 is chemically more efficient in general, which is also why it destroys the ozone, right? So there's some wins and losses.
That was
there.
DuPont. We already established this, Austin.
Oh, sorry. My bad. Yeah. My bad. Yes. I'm also a paid representative from DuPont on the side. So the thing about the Freon, though, is that you can do what you're saying. It's actually a pretty common practice. It's sort of like a test charge where people will add like 30 PSI to the system. They'll use the little green sniffer thing or the orange sniffer, maybe from like Harbor Freight, if you're familiar. They'll like beep around to find it. And then they'll drain it out and do it properly. That's pretty common. You can also do it with nitrogen. Problem with nitrogen is it's impossible to sniff for, but you can run nitrogen at really high pressures, obviously without too much cost, no effect to the ozone, easy to clean up. And nitrogen is extremely small compared to both Freon types. So if you do have a leak with nitrogen, it might be okay. But if you don't have a leak with nitrogen, you are good to go for life on all the R134A stuff.
This is ridiculous. So I'm trying to, I wanted to find out how much more efficient R12 was than R134. So I asked our AI friend, it says it's 2% less efficient than R12. I said,
that's it?
Are you sure it's not? I said, are you sure it's not more? That seems wrong. It says, I apologize for the confusion. Let me correct that. R134 is generally considered to be about 4 to 6% less than R12. And I said,
where's it getting wrong information?
Too.
Yeah.
I said, that's wrong too. It just goes, I apologize for the oversight. It's actually 4%. I said, that's wrong. I think it's 10%. He goes, you are correct. It is 10%.
Wow. I don't believe anything that AI says then.
Oh, yeah. It's just absolute garbage. Yeah. It is absolute
just
garbage.
To you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right.
So who knows? It's like a giant mystery.
Let's see.
Holy cow.
Okay, so I can do the test charge or whatever. I didn't know if there was incompatible oils in the charge fluids or whatever that would be an issue.
Well, that's the other thing, too. So if you're going to do straight R12, you should be okay. But I'm guessing you're going to get, or sorry, R134, you're probably going to get like a can from the store, huh?
Mm-hmm. The pressures that they operate in are different, too. So I don't know that I would do this.
Well, you can do it for like a test. But
well,
you can't. Obviously, I would not recommend fully running this. What expansion valve are you using?
I don't remember. I have no idea. I haven't looked at this thing in a year.
It's okay. I'll send you a part number. I know what it is. Anyways, the fun thing about this is like you can do what you're saying. There's going to be probably like for every 12 ounces, there's probably like half an ounce or 1 ounce of lubricant just to help it get out of the can, right? Okay. And that way it like can semi lubricate the system. That's usually not a problem. But when you get the cans, they specifically say like stop leak, extra lubricant, UV dye. You've probably
don't
seen all those little like additives. Don't get any of that stuff.
You don't.
You're not going to want it.
Austin,
if you do get it.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you do get it, there are actually special cans that say R12 compatible, which usually means that they have a ester oil mixed
which
in
is
it.
Good
so
on
like
both.
PAG 46.
Okay. I like
exactly.
It.
So you just
like
don't want to run full PAG.
Got it.
I wanted to branch a little bit off into manufacturing processes and what you've learned. I'm really, really interested in, as you roll into doing this 9/11 project, for example, what are some of the challenges that you see as you look at the system and you look at what you have to do? And what challenges have you encountered in the past and how do you overcome some of the manufacturing issues that you run into?
Yeah, so like manufacturing specifically or more like product design?
Let's go with both. Like whatever challenges you the most with what you're doing.
So yeah, I think one of the hardest things is, first of all, I did not go to school. I'm not an engineer. I didn't go to school for, you know, being an engineer or supply chain logistics or cost estimations or any of this stuff. The hardest part about all the manufacturing is nobody, I mean, this is the classic like Elon Musk take, right? Nobody ever talks about manufacturing in general. Everybody talks about a first article or, you know, a prototype design, or look, we made a million of these things and like you can go buy one today. But nobody talks about the process to make a million things. So the thing I always tell myself and sort of have to remind myself is it's very easy to build something once. And this is the perfect use case when you like think about building custom parts for a car, right? You go to Home Depot, you like start mocking it up with some steel, then you maybe sit down and design it in like Fusion, and then maybe you make it with Sendcut Send, right? Which is a great supplier for like doing small prototype stuff. And then you have one. But you haven't actually gone through the engineering exercise to test that, to make sure it works on all the models, all the variants, all the possible configurations. You know, what happens if somebody has a worn out, you know, engine mount, and then there's a little bit of rubbing, and then there's some more vibration. How is it going to fit? All these kind of things. The hardest part is being able to take that design, modify it to the point where it's universal enough for whatever application you're building it for, and then confidently put it in an order for 1,000, 2,000 units and know that they're all going to be perfect. And the other issue with that is obviously cost. It's very expensive to do that correctly. I've made many, many mistakes and learned the hard way, but it's also time. So back to the first example, when you build one part, it might only take you 2 or 3 weeks. That seems like a lot of time because you spent a lot of time building a custom part, but at the end of 2 or 3 weeks, you might have one. And maybe you spent 3 times as much as you should, but at least you have it. It's right there. Doing production orders can be, you know, 2 or 3 months for like even simple sheet metal manufacturing, which is like very basic, big roll of steel, stamp, cut, fold, plate, done. It just depends on how complicated it is. So when I look at like the Porsche stuff, to go back to your question, like there are certain parts of that car that I know super easy, I can do this in a couple weeks, right? And there are other parts of the car that I know are going to take 1 to 2 years. And an example of that is obviously one of the sponsors you guys have here, Ravi at CSF, has been a fantastic sort of just mentor and also great business partner, both as a friend, but also between ACS and CSF, we've done a lot of really cool stuff. And that is one of the first conversations I had, because I knew that that process, being as complicated as it is to build custom parts for the 911, is going to probably take one of the longest. And it's not any fault of his manufacturing, it's just part of the process. So that's how I look at like taking on projects like this. And then the actual product design, like tweaking it and making things, you know, exactly what we need for, you know, certain ports and sizes and like getting the configuration, all that's pretty easy to do. That's mostly just R&D. But the actual, like, how long is it going to take if I theoretically had a perfect design done and I wanted to submit, how long is that going to take? Is that a 2 week process? Is that 6 years? And that's very hard to understand if you haven't done it.
Have you made any costly, like really costly mistakes that you're just like,
oh yeah,
like I'm just, oh, like, man, I can't do this anymore.
You mean
I
need to just move on. He doesn't want to talk about, and so shouldn't ask.
This month or last year. Yeah. there's definitely a lot. I'm very much in the like thought process of build and iterate all the time. I know many people that don't like this approach. There's a lot of negatives to it, but I also know a lot of people that will spend 3 or 4 years building something.
Can you explain what that means? I don't know what that build iterate process means.
Yeah. So it's like it's definitely like more of a software oriented approach. It's very challenging to apply in manufacturing, but it does have its applications at times. It's just a little more expensive when you have to fix things. The idea of like sitting down and building something from like start to finish, right? That is, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to build 100 units, I'm going to test them, I'm going to blah, 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 I'm going to do all these things. And then you can have them in the store, stocked, ready to go on your online store, whatever. You could start selling them and then like have issues. That can still happen if you iterate along the way. The problem with the first example of that is it may have taken you 2 or 3 years to do this, right? 2 or 3 years to get the product ready to go to sell. And in the meantime, either somebody's going to do it better than you, someone could do it cheaper than you, or somebody's going to absolutely make your product invalid. And if you considerably like cut down the amount of time that you're going to work on innovating something, where you come out with a first version and you do the things you really know, you can ship it. Everybody complains, oh, kit should have this, you should have these, you should have these 40 things. You're like, yes, yes, great, I know this, but I have to get this one out there to really understand what that means. That's like the iteration, right? So we always have like multiple versions coming out all the time in order to like support different product lines. That's most of what I've done. The issue with that is that it also creates a lot of expensive, costly mistakes, which I've definitely been a part of. And it's definitely not fun, but that is, it is sort of a side effect. But the blessing in disguise is that obviously you can generate capital to redesign the product and support the previous iteration of the product, as well as improve and create future iterations of that product.
So do you think your ability to do that is, I feel like that's kind of like, if you look at the big three and what the big auto manufacturers do, they're all so slow because they don't do what you're doing. And I think some of the smaller companies like Rivian and, you know, Tesla initially were maybe doing more of the way you do things versus the legacy way of doing it.
I think it's might be a little bit more R&D, sort of like test and sell than you think. I think a lot of like large auto manufacturers, especially like BMW, Porsche, like all the big guys, they will like develop products and then you'll see like technical updates, right? Either it's things that they've planned for or not planned for. Like they are all the time iterating to try to create new products that nobody's ever used, right? And this could be, when I say like new products, I mean like maybe a new design for an oil filter housing, right? So they might create that new product, ship it in a car, and then discover a couple years from today that that's a problem. Like they did not anticipate that it would be the best solution, but they knew that it would work. So then they'll take that iteration and like constantly reiterate. At the same time, like you're not going to get a new car from Porsche if you have that problem, but they're constantly building new things and making technical updates for things that they may have had a planned obsolescence for, or knew that they were going to create, or knew they ran out of time. I think the issue with like the big auto manufacturers is there's just so many moving pieces at any given time, which goes back to manufacturing, right? There's so many things they can't control.
When you're Rivian, this is like almost like a detriment. Like if you think, imagine if everybody at Porsche suddenly had amnesia and they forgot everything that they'd done, everything that they'd built before, and they had to completely innovate from scratch. But it was the same people, right? It was the same people. They saw everything they'd learned, all the talents and the skill sets, and they had to design a new car. It could be something incredible, but because they're so hamstrung by what they've iterated over the last, you know, like 100, whatever, what is it, says 50 years, say 70 years or whatever it is, 75 years, they're hamstrung by it. They have to do things, the iterative design of going through all these things over the course of years. If you look at the 911, it's progressively this. Now pretty much all we do is put stupid wings on things and put wider tires on it and hope Michelin has engineered better rubber. That's what we're doing now. But like, imagine if there was amnesia and they could all start over and we could have a brand new concept of what all the brilliant people at Porsche are capable of, but they don't have to do anything.
Like the Taycan and the Cayman when it came out?
No, I don't think so. But here's the problem.
Like if they parked it, right? And let's say just said like, all right, no more 911s until we really rethink this whole car. Someone else is just going to destroy it, right? There's going to be somebody that's going to come in and fill that gap. So they can't sit there and spend the next, what would probably take them 10 years to fully redecide from an engineering standpoint on what the new, you know, two-seater sports car from Porsche was going to look like. They can't afford to.
Well, that's how you end up with
Rivian,
though. Look what Rivian is doing. Their products are absolutely incredible. It's like a clean sheet, new thing, you know, and it's everybody has the opportunity to design something without the hamstring injury of everything that came before it, because there's nothing that came before. It's a new company. They can do whatever they want. They can be inspired by whatever they want. It doesn't need to look like the next. It doesn't need to look like a 911. It doesn't need to look like an F-150. It doesn't need to look like a Silverado. It can look like anything they want it to look like. And it can be anything they want it to look like. It's incredible that they're able to do that. And I love that part about the EV revolution that we're having. And look, I don't really want an electric car, but I think the simplicity of the design of an electric car and how it's propelled is very, it's much easier than designing like a combustion engine from scratch, right? It just is. You know, you got the skateboards everywhere.
Counterpoint, Chris, though, like that all makes great sense in theory, but you're not taking into account the common person. Guess what? They're still selling more F-150s than they are Rivians because people know it. That's what they're used to. And that's also the reason people love Porsche and the 911. Oh, because it has the history. It has the nostalgia of it. It's always been rear engine. It's still rear engine. And people went up in arms when they tried to reinnovate and make a 928 to replace it. You remember? That's exactly what that was, that point in history.
Yeah.
And it didn't work because the market didn't accept
it. This is also a different argument because you're talking about very mature companies like building new products at scale, right? I'm talking more of like from a small, super small manufacturing standpoint, right? Like there are people that have these ideas, right? They could be really good ideas and they could spend 10 years in the basement developing them. The problem is that if they did that and they turned off everything and they ignored everything except for building this one perfect product, by the time it comes out, it might suck because somebody else has iterated and developed the whole time. Not that they're iterating and developing garbage products that making consumers test to do the work for them. That's like definitely, that's a totally, right. I don't
There's a balance
that.
There.
A totally different approach. There's a balance though. Yeah. So yes, anyways, I kind of lost track of what I was going to get at.
No,
yeah.
I was just going to clarify that for listeners and potential customers. It's not like you were saying you're putting prototypes out there and that's what you're selling. And if they work, maybe they work.
Yeah.
Right. Like these are well-developed design units and you have put a lot of R&D into them,
right.
But you're also trying to innovate and do new things and work on new markets, such as the 911. So,
yeah. And we have to be really like, I think back to the manufacturing question, right? And like the challenges, that's one of the biggest issues, right? In terms of cash flow is how much money you want to spend into new engineering practices that we can cut costs and obviously improve quality on existing product lines, as opposed to doing R&D on new product lines. And the issue is that for the last, you know, year, and I've been doing this for about 4 years now, I think, these things are just overlapping every single month all the time. Right. So I don't have a choice anymore. Right. We are doing R&D and spending a lot of money on new product lines. And we're spending a lot of money on improving existing product lines. And like I thought at one point in time, and everybody's told me this is not the case, that, you know, I have other friends that sort of do this stuff on the side, is these things will always continue to compete forever and ever for as long as you want to improve the product and improve the company. Like there is no, the second that dies, like the company will go away. And that's the issue, is that like you will always have an investment into the future and an investment of the past. And for the manufacturing side, all of that, again, did not go to school for. So it's been a phenomenal learning experience. It's like an MBA on steroids for the last 4 or 5 years. But
all right. Can you guys see my screen right now?
Yes.
You guys see my screen?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
I'm going to find out quickly.
Oh, boy.
If Austin is a driver's club player. We're going to see if Austin has joined the driver's club.
Oh, where is, you could just ask him. But I
think but this is more fun. Whereas there he is, right there. Yeah. He's got
there
the blue with the little snowflake.
I see where we're going with this. Yep. You too could be part of the Driver's Club and be as cool as Austin for as little as $5 a month. Head over to overcrestproductions.com/Driver's Club. You get exclusive access to that Discord where all the cool people are, as well as a whole back catalog of content as well.
Yeah,
I said as well. Three times.
Plus, you're not a freeloader. See all these, like when you're looking at this, see all the like white names that I scrolled by?
Freeloaders.
I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of people there that are just freeloading cheapskates. It's $5.
I will say, on the Overcrest or Driver's Club note, I was a freebie, but I was paying. But I was hiding as a freebie on the Discord until I found out there was a whole other subsection of the
humble,
Discord. Specific.
He's the humble lender.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was being the wholesome
a humble supporter.
Discord.
Oh, Austin, that's a good callback.
Thank you for coming on and hanging out with us and listening to us banter about this stuff. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for being part of the rally and believing in what Overcrest does. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It speaks volumes about your company. We really, really appreciate you, probably more than you know. We're pretty grassroots too, and we're glad that you're here, and we're happy to support you in any way that you need. Please let us know and develop air conditioning for my 911, please.
We're working on it. Thank you, guys. You guys are amazing. I will see you in Utah.
All right, take care.
Awesome. See ya.
All right, cheers.